Hi, everybody. We're recording today's episode of Adapting the Future of Jewish Education on December 16, 2022, just a few days before Hanukkah. And we thought it was as good a time as any to reflect upon the last few seasons of Adapting and where we've come from over the last 2+ years. So I thought that I'd start by just letting you all in on the little secret as to why I started Adapting in the first place. And the truth is, we were sitting in the beginning of what was a six-week lockdown. And I thought, hang on a second, there might be an opportunity for me to start connecting and reconnecting with friends and colleagues in the field. And that's sort of the origin story of Adapting. And before we knew it, we were having a few live episodes with people listening in on the sides. And then we morphed into a podcast. And all of a sudden, there were actually people listening to this, giving us feedback, commenting, and telling us how important it was to hear about Jewish education and the way it was or was not adapting during the COVID pandemic. To be honest, there have been several times in the last couple of years where I've thought about, you know, putting it aside and focusing on other things. And then every so often, just like 2 weeks ago at the Foundation for Jewish Camp Leaders Assembly, I was approached by more than one, maybe a dozen people who said they've listened to a particular episode of Adapting that had resonance with them. And that gives me the impetus to keep talking about these issues with some really important friends, colleagues, people that I'm just beginning to meet in the field of Jewish education. So the logical question which people then ask me is, well, which were my favorite episodes? And more often than not, I usually say it's the last one that I recorded because that's the one which sticks with me the most. But when I come to think of it a bit more, it's actually not the episodes where I'm talking to my colleagues who confirm what I was already thinking before the episode, but it's those episodes where I've spoken to so many people who have made me think, rethink, think twice again about the issues that they've raised. And these might be issues which either keep me up at night or wake me up in the morning, but it's been a real privilege to be able to talk to so many diverse people over the course of our time with Adapting. And today we wanted to bring you back to May 13th, 2020, our actual first episode of Adapting with Maya Bernstein. And I wanted to re-release that episode for a couple of reasons. And the first is, you'll see, it's actually pretty moving and nostalgic to hear what it was like back in those first weeks of the pandemic. It was really poignant for me to re-listen to that and to think about all that has happened since that time. And I wonder how we will tell this piece of history in decades and years to come, how our children will remember this time of their lives where they were wearing masks and getting vaccines. And you'll hear some of the reference points that Maya talks about as being really poignant in that regard. The second reason is that Maya comes out already talking about our educators as some of our heroes, being on the front line of their work, doing this incredibly important work. And wow, boy, has that message been intensified over the last few years. And I thought that alone was worth re-releasing so that everybody out there listening can acknowledge the absolute heroics that our educators have done in Jewish education and beyond during these really difficult years. And then the final reason was, we asked Maya to be our first guest on Adapting because she actually talks about what Adapting is, what it means to be an adaptive leader, the reasons as to why adaptive leadership was going to be and is continuing to be so important now, and talks about some of the challenges that only people who take an adaptive leadership approach can really utilize when talking about the issues that they confront in Jewish education. So I thought today was as good a time as any to ask some key questions. Has Jewish education actually adapted? What's actually changed in Jewish education over the last few years? And what has stayed the same? I think significantly, and those of you who know me and have listened to many of these episodes will realize that the question of have we seized this opportunity or have we missed the opportunity is something which I really think about quite a lot. And I'm also really clear in understanding that this COVID story has not fully been told and there's still a lot to be unpacked as we move forward. So I really think the issues that adaptive leadership raises and that Maya talks about in this re-release are really as critical now as they ever have been. But lastly, there's one special part of this episode that I want you to really pay attention to, and that's when Maya talks about loss. And she talks about loss as a part of adaptive leadership, that when any change process occurs, that we actually lose some things as well. And I want to just really briefly reflect upon loss during these last 2 years. And it's really poignant for me to acknowledge that we've lost a few educators. Physically, a few have died during this time, and a few Jewish educators, some close to me, have passed on in these last 2 years, some as a direct result of COVID. In more general terms, we know of many Jewish educators who have burnt out and it's all become too much for them and we've lost some of them to the field. We also know of many programs that have come and gone during the pandemic because they couldn't withstand the pressures of the finances that the pandemic brought with it as well. And I also want to acknowledge that relationships have been strained, that we haven't always been at our best over Zoom, and we haven't had those in-person encounters. And I think on that last point, I also want to use this as an opportunity to apologize on behalf of myself and anyone who I might have hurt when trying to push the envelope a bit too far and had a little less regard than I otherwise would have for the person involved in some of the change processes that we were actually pushing. But that's what part of being an adaptive leader is about. It's acknowledging that this is going to be a difficult process, but sometimes the need to change is actually outweighing the human instinct to try and keep things constant. So who knows what the future holds? But one thing I do know for sure is that if you're listening to this podcast, and I really do believe that you are not just part of Jewish education today, but that you are also an intrinsic and integral part of adapting the future of Jewish education for tomorrow. And now it's over to Maya, Maya Bernstein, who over the years has certainly made me think and rethink most things about Jewish education and leadership. Thank you all for listening. Have a happy Hanukkah. Be well.
This is Adapting, the Future of Jewish Education, a podcast from the Jewish Education Project, where we explore the big questions, challenges, and successes that define Jewish education. I'm David Breifman.
It's my absolute pleasure to have Maya with me today. You're going to hear in just a few moments why she's the perfect guest to kick us off. But what I really want to do is ask Maya to introduce herself, tell us a bit about herself, her family, what she's doing, and also importantly, how she's coping, what she's doing during this pandemic. So Maya, welcome. Let's get started.
Thank you so much, David. Thanks for the warm welcome. And hello to all of you who are joining as I'm looking at this chat from really all over the world, Brazil and Israel and across the US. It's really inspiring. And I want to start by thanking you because we know the health workers are on the front line in this pandemic. And I think the educators are on the front line as well. There's never been such clear emphasis and attention around the need for good education for our children. So there's a lot to say, but I'll start by saying that I've always been interested in the intersection of tradition and innovation. That's something that's been inspiring and challenging to me my entire life and my entire career. I started out working for the Ronald Lauder Foundation in Minsk in Belarus, and then living in Germany, working with Jews from the former Soviet Union. I was a Russian major, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do, and I sort of fell into Jewish education. When I was in Minsk, I had this realization that my own background, I went to Jewish day school in New York City, that was a body of knowledge and a gift. I had never perceived it in that way. And so I actually felt a sense of imperative to give back to the community, and that sense of passion and excitement and energy and challenge of how do we keep this tradition relevant? How do we ensure that it continues to nurture us and that we continue to nurture it from the beginning has been one of my passions. As David said, I worked for Upstart for 10 years. I had the great privilege of working with Toby Rubin when she was imagining how the Jewish community could evolve, both in terms of nurturing new initiatives in the Jewish community and trying to inspire innovation, but then also working with our phenomenal established Jewish community to try and help them adapt and innovate. And we'll talk more about how I think back then it felt like a choice. Do we want to innovate? Do we not want to innovate? How much do we want to innovate? And right now, we're all forced into adaptation. And then now I'm doing a lot of teaching. I teach for the Wexner Foundation and for Yeshivat Maharat and at Georgetown Institute of Transformational Leadership, for the Masa Leadership Center. So I'm sort of back to my passion of teaching. So that's a little bit on the professional side.
What about the family? How are they?
The family. So as I'm sure everybody is grappling with their own challenges of being at home. Some of us are alone. Some of us are a lot more isolated. My family is in the overwhelming situation of having lots of us in this ship. So I have 5 children at home and 4 of them go to Jewish day school. And so I've been eavesdropping and participating in a lot of Zoom learning. I've become the smoothie maker. My 6th and 8th graders have decided that they can't get through Zoom school without a fresh smoothie each morning. So there's the joys and the challenges of having everybody in the house. Also, my husband, Noam Silverman, is the principal of Heschel High School. And so I have that perspective as well as being the partner of somebody who's running a school right now and facing that set of challenges. And also, I'll shout out to my daughter who had one of, I think, the first Zoom mitzvahs back in early March. She had been looking forward to her bat mitzvah, as all kids do, for a really long time. And she read the Megillah online and still isn't quite over that. So we're dealing with a lot of ups and downs, as I'm sure everybody is.
I think we'll talk a bit about what it means to go through some of those ups and especially the downs as well, both on a personal and a professional sense as well. So we called this whole series Adapting, and we meant to really riff off a term which has become common parlance in the Jewish community in many ways. And that's the term that you're most familiar with. And I think you're also one of the people that taught it to me, the term of adaptive leadership. And I really want to try and delve into a bit about adaptive leadership today, because it'll give people an insight as to why we think it's an important concept that really undergirds a lot of what we're trying to accomplish, not just with this series, but also in all of the work that many of us are engaged in. So how would you define adaptive leadership? And let's move from there.
Okay, so I guess I want to start by honoring the founders and the thinkers about this approach to leadership. Ron Heifetz and Marty Linsky and Alexander Grasha are amongst my teachers in this. And maybe, David, I'll start by thinking about what it means to be in adaptive times, right? We're talking about how challenging these times are, and I think that the framework of adaptive leadership can help us maybe understand why these times are so challenging. So one way to think about what we're going through is that we're all going through an adaptive process that none of us signed up for. And some of the characteristics of that process are, first of all, there are no existing solutions. So nobody can clearly say, okay, this is what's wrong, and this is how we're going to fix it. Even in terms of understanding scientifically the nature of this virus, to all of the ramifications of how do we return to society, how do we educate ourselves, how do we feed ourselves, how do we interact with each other, there are no clear solutions. So that's one of the characteristics of this kind of adaptive environment in which we're operating. Another characteristic of adaptive times is that there's a radical change from how things have been to how things are going to be, both in terms of everyday life and in terms of big picture questions. What's the future of work? What's the future of our global healthcare? How do we think about education going forward for all students? So this radical change from how things have been, and we were thrust into it against our wills very, very quickly. That's another characteristic. I think another characteristic of adaptive times, of a way of knowing if you're in an adaptive process, is tremendous exhaustion. I think a lot of us are having trouble sleeping at night. There's physical fatigue, but there's also emotional stress and fatigue. There's spiritual stress and fatigue. Each of us is literally worried for our lives and for the lives of our loved ones. So that's another characteristic of this kind of environment. It lands differently for each of us. There's a meme going around that we're all in the same storm, but we're all in different boats. And I think that that's very powerful. It's true socioeconomically. It's true across racial lines. It's true in terms of our own histories with trauma and our own experiences in our lives. So the sense that we all experience this very differently, and that's part of what makes leadership so hard, because everybody's in a different boat. And then it also has phases. I think that's another characteristic of adaptive times. You can think of the metaphor of an emergency physical situation where somebody's rushed to an emergency room. There's that triage phase where you just try and stabilize the patient. And I think we've had a particularly long triage phase. We may still be in it, of just trying to stabilize. But then the next phase is really trying to discover, well, what's the diagnosis? What's going on with this person? And then, okay, what are we going to do about it to help them? And then how is this person going to maybe make changes in his or her life so that this doesn't happen again? So we don't even know what the phases of this are. We're probably still in either the first or the very beginning of the second phase. And then finally, this environment of adaptation requires muscle building. It's going to require us to learn skills and to operate in ways that we haven't before. I'll turn it back to you, but I think that it's important to maybe have some of this information in our heads when we think about, well, why are these times so challenging?
So that's it's an interesting concept in terms of you're talking here about, you use the word radical even a few times, radical change or uncertainty. And I'm hearing the word thrown around a lot in the community now about pivoting. And pivoting is like, in my mind, it's a small motion, right? Like it's a small detour. I mean, in basketball, which I do not play, you actually keep one foot on the ground and then you're moving direction. You're literally just, you know, changing your orientation as you pivot. But what you're suggesting is perhaps something a bit more, this is the less comforting part, I guess, about what you're saying, is that what might be required of us is not just a pivot, but some sort of radical reorientation to an unknown future. And that's actually a bit daunting for me right now to hear you say that.
Yes, I think that we can hold both gently, but I think that we literally can't play basketball with each other right now, right? If we're going to use the pivoting metaphor, we can't pivot. We have to rethink the game. And I think that's part of what an overarching global adaptive change is forcing upon us. There will be things that are similar and might require tweaks, right? And so those, I think that's the language of pivoting. But there's also going to be a requirement to let go of certain things that have been our norms and practices. And that's connected to our sense of identity and connected to our values. And we may have to actually let go of some of that in order to move forward.
All right. So now I get it. I'm a CEO, right? I've got this position. I've got a title. My job is to lead. You're giving me all of these extra tasks. Now I've got to think radically and I've got to change and do all of this stuff. But am I the only one who can lead? Like, just because I've given this title, like, what is it? Does that like get everyone else off the hook? Or what role does everybody play when you're trying to solve an adaptive issue that you're talking about?
Yeah. So one of the, I think, most beautiful distinctions that adaptive leadership theory makes is between leadership and authority. And I remember being particularly shaken when I learned this distinction, right? That we tend to think about leaders, and we even have this noun, the leaders, the people who are in charge, who tell us what to do or who are charismatic, and we follow them. And David, you're the CEO, so you're going to have the answers. You're going to tell us what to do, and you know, I'll march and follow your orders. But this theory argues that leadership and authority are actually two very different sets of responsibilities, and that authority is a position, right? So anybody who's in a position of authority, the CEO, the president, the parent, to the principal, that they're actually the expectations that we have for our authority figures are to provide protection, direction, and order in our systems, essentially to maintain the status quo at the highest level possible. The work of navigating an adaptive change often requires us to be in a state of a little bit of chaos, or to acknowledge that we don't have the answers, or maybe to say, I don't know how to fully protect you in this moment. And that's the work of leadership. The work of leadership involves stepping into the unknown and trying to help people bridge that gap from what is the current situation to our desired future situation when we don't really know how to get from point A to point B. And so what's, I think, particularly challenging right now is that for people in positions of authority, we know that when we are stressed and when we're worried, we revert and regress to become more dependent on authority. I find that with my kids. I've got kids walking into our bed every night, you know, needing to have a drink of water and needing to have their stomachs ache soothed, right? That's a pattern you're going to see in your organizations. That's a pattern you're going to see amongst your students and in your faculties. People want to be cared for more. And yet, what leadership requires in this moment is actually sometimes to disappoint that expectation, to say, I don't have the answer. Can you join me in entering this unknown? And so leadership, we can think about more as a verb and less as a noun. And yes, anybody can engage in leadership. The challenge is when you're engaging in leadership from a position of authority, people are going to be angry or frustrated or even frightened because they're expecting you to protect them. And when you don't have authority, you don't necessarily have that platform from which people will listen to you. And so you have to figure out how to build the informal authority and partner with authority to be able to try and make a difference. And I think that authority figures need to essentially live in the paradox of continuing to provide to the best of their capability that direction and protection and order, and simultaneously, paradoxically, admit and name that I don't have the answers and I don't know what's happening in September, if we're going back to school or if we're not going back to school or if we're going partially back to school. I don't know if they're going to have a vaccine in the next year or 2 years or 3 years, right? To be able to name that, I think, allows us to continue to trust our authority figures. We don't want to lean too much on the side of direction, protection, and order, and then not be fully honest, because then when in September things are still chaotic, you've lost that precious commodity of trust. So I think that actually giving the work back is another big concept in adaptive leadership. I think that giving the work back right now maybe ironically builds trust in authority.
So we'll come back to this when we get really into some of the examples with Jewish education. But one more piece I just want to push you on a bit. Like, and then I get to the stage where I am making a decision, right? And if I make a decision which has consequences, the status quo is not going to be the same by definition because I've brought in some change, right? The status quo exists in most organizations because a lot of people like the status quo. And now I've done something to destabilize it. And someone's going to turn around to me and say, well, we've always done it that way. Or how can you change that? Or are you serious? It's only your first year of leadership. I've been here for 20, whatever it might be. Change isn't easy. And if it's the right change, which I think you're talking about, there's going to be a change for the positive, we hope. There also might be a deficit that occurs somewhere along that spectrum.
Yeah, so this is the whole realm of loss. And, you know, right now we're literally experiencing loss of lives all around us. And so it's very visceral how in an adaptive process there's loss and pain. And the same, unfortunately, is going to have to be true in our communities and in our organizations. By definition, if we're trying to move from the status quo to a new reality, we're going to have to leave some pieces of the status quo behind. So one way of thinking about leadership in this context is that it's disappointing your own people at a rate they can stand, right? That you're going to have to help them. It's grief management through the loss. And this rate they can stand is very important because that's part of the work of leadership, is figuring out how to pace that process. How much can they handle, especially given, you know, the context in which we're operating, where people are afraid and people are suffering financially and people are thoroughly frazzled with their dealing with their children or with their parents. So the sense of acknowledging that there is going to have to be loss, naming that you don't know how much loss, right? But also figuring out how to pace it, and disappointing people so that you disappoint them just enough that they don't run away or, you know, take away your authority completely, right? That's also part of the challenge. That's part of leadership work, and there's no clear answer.
Okay. So now we've been on for like less than 20 minutes, and you've told me we have to change because we've got no choice. Anyone can bring about the change. The changes have to be rather radical if they're going to have an impact. You've got to do it with other people, and guess what? You're also going to disappoint people along the way if you do it right. So for those people who just like logged in for some sort of easy solution to what's necessary for Jewish education, I think we've just sort of like woken them up to a different sort of reality that's really required right now. I'm a classroom teacher, I'm a camp counselor, literally, and let's use a metaphor that I do know from the literature of adaptive leadership, like I'm in the mix, I'm on the dance floor, and I'm doing what I need to do in order to maybe just get through the next day. So let's use this metaphor of dance floor balcony. Maybe you can explain that to our listeners and explain how one who's so immersed in the weeds can also begin to see the bigger picture of what really is out there for them to confront.
Yeah, so the dance floor and balcony is a lovely metaphor for, I think, what we're all experiencing. The dance floor is what it sounds like. The music is pounding, the lights are flashing, there are sweaty bodies all around you, you're moving, you can't really see who's dancing next to whom, and somebody's stepping on your toes. It's very hard to get perspective, but you're in it and you're fully engaged. The balcony is where I like to be. You sort of run away and you get to look at everybody from above and you begin to see patterns. Oh, that person's dancing with that person and that person's standing alone on the side, dance after dance after dance. And wait a minute, the DJ's been playing this certain type of song for a really long time. What's going on? The challenge is to be on the dance floor and the balcony at the same time. And I actually think the teachers are very, very good at this. So are therapists, so are rabbis, so are parents when we are at our best selves, right? You know, the other day my daughter was yelling at me, I hate you. You're the worst mom in the world. I never want to talk to you again. That's a dance floor moment, right? My amygdala hijack, right? My kid hates me. Even though we read about kids saying that, it hurts when they say it. Was I able to be, and sometimes I am and sometimes I'm not, listening to, wait a minute, this is a kid who's really upset about something. And maybe she's trying to tell me something else. Maybe it has nothing to do with me. Maybe it has to do with how she's feeling about not being with her friends or not being in school. So that ability to be in the present moment, but also have perspective on what's going on, I think is a metaphor on two levels for us. First, I think it's especially challenging to be on the balcony and the dance floor as a teacher. In general, right? You're trying to teach your lesson plan, then you got to figure out who's not participating and how do we get them involved and what time is it and do I have time to get through all this material and who's acting out and why might they be acting out and how do I handle that? I think that's especially challenging on Zoom, teaching on Zoom and even discipline on Zoom, but I think that that's a balcony dance floor challenge. But David, what I think you're asking me is actually a bigger question of, can we get through the rest of the school year and figure out summer camp while simultaneously thinking about what are the ramifications of this for the next 10 years, for the next 20 years, for the next 50 years? How is it changing in exciting ways that we should be taking advantage of? Like Rahm Emanuel, you know, early on in the Obama administration said, don't let a good crisis go to waste, right? We've actually been pushed into making changes that maybe we were just starting to think about or talk about, and now we're doing them. So how do we hold on to that while simultaneously navigating the exhaustion of day-to-day life?
I know now is not the real time to boast about one's children, but my child, my 10-year-old, just created the best Minecraft version of Kibbutz Degania that I've seen, and cows and chickens, the whole bit. We had a guided tour the other night, so that was great as well. So I'm going to transition now, focusing specifically on this Jewish education enterprise that we're engaged in. And I don't know if I ever told you this, but when I teach a course on Jewish education, I actually start with an article that you wrote a few years ago, which appears in Zeek magazine, now online, that we'll refer to. And the opening of this article that Maya writes about is she talks about the purpose of Jewish education, and she uses this metaphor of fire, and literally the word purpose comes from, I believe it's the Indo-Chinese root of the word pur, meaning light or fire, and this whole metaphor, like what lights it up. And I'm interested to ask you now, I do caveat this by saying that you've acknowledged to me offline that you're not a Jewish educator, but I want to ask you, in your experience, how do you define the purpose, the essence of Jewish education?
So it's a big question. You know, it's funny, I hadn't read that article in a long time, and we'll put the link in if you Google Zeek, purpose of Jewish education, but we'll put that link in. I would say I have more answers than questions, but I think it's a question that I'm not sure we ask enough. I think this question of why are we dedicating so much time and all of our resources to this enterprise of Jewish education, everything from day schools to camps to communities. I've been thinking about this since we spoke, David, a couple of days ago in preparation, and I was thinking about the quote from Echad Ha'am, who talks about how, and I'm not going to get the exact quote, but more than the Jews have kept the Sabbath has kept the Jews. And I think that that dual street, that relationship of there's something in Jewish life, in Jewish culture, in our texts, in our practices, in our calendar, in our ethics, in our tikkun olam mentality that helps us become better people. It's the vehicle through which we show up in the world and hopefully contribute to the endeavor of being a human being trying to improve this world. And it has to work the other way too, right? That culture, that tradition, that set of practices, that set of texts needs to be studied and analyzed. We need skills, we need depth, we need exposure to it in order to continue to allow it to be relevant so that it continue to affect us. And I think this dual street of trying to create human beings who are passionate about their Jewish identities, who are passionate about contributing to the world in meaningful, positive ways to help this world, and to do it through that Jewish lens, and simultaneously to then be nurtured, right? To both be nurtured and nurture Jewish tradition, I think is somewhere in the heart of the purpose of Jewish education. And I think I also want to talk about joy. I think that that shouldn't be left out. I have to say, watching my children who go to SAR Academy on some of their Zoom community gatherings, the Havdalah that they do on a Saturday night, or the, you know, before Shabbat singing on the steps, right? Regardless of our denomination or our religious orientation, something about coming together in joyous connection as a Jewish community feels deep and profound to me, more now than ever before.
Okay, so I happen to buy into your purpose framework, but I want to push you a bit because there was a word which was missing from all of that, which I think is important, because the word which appears most common in a general traditional definitional sense of what is education, that's the word knowledge or content or stuff or yep. Torah. And in some circles, education is classically defined as the transmission of knowledge and skills from one generation to the next. So I'm asking you here, like, what role does knowledge, what role does Torah, small t, wisdom have in what you talked about, which is pretty much a relational sort of approach to what Jewish education should be espousing, but what role does knowledge acquisition have in your understanding here?
Yeah, thank you. I think that it's critical. I think that it's the doorway through which we get to all of those emotions and sense of identity and sense of commitment to one another and to the world. I'm a big believer in teaching skills, right? I think that's critical. I think that's what allows us to make this tradition our own. And I also say that the question of Jewish education has two pieces. There's the Jewish piece, which I've been talking about, but there's the education piece, right? Especially if we think about day schools in particular, but also supplementary schools, right? We are trying to also educate our children, not just for a Jewish life, but for life in general. And I think just like the debate around what does Jewish mean, there's also a debate around, well, what does it mean to prepare a child for the 21st century? I think we don't don't know the answer to that. I think that's radically changing as well. There's radical again, right? But the question of what's the future of work with artificial intelligence and robotics and cobotics, this new term about how we're going to be living in conjunction with robots and working together with them. It reminds me of, I used to watch this show called Small Wonder in the 1980s. I don't know if anybody knows it, but literally this family had like a robot sister that slept in the closet and you could turn her on and off. So apparently we're moving towards that kind of world. So I think there are huge questions around how do we need to educate? What skills do we need to be giving our kids, both Jewishly, but then also in general, to set them up for the future success?
So I don't know if you want to comment on this. I didn't have this in the preempting questions, but I'm not talking about your family, but in general, do you see gender differences playing themselves out here? Or are you attuned to anything that's happening between male and female caregivers, parenting styles? What's taking place for Jewish families in particular? Do you have any insights there or hunches what might be happening?
You know, it's hard to give a clear answer to that. I'm coming from a family where I'm married to a man and we have a lot of children and we are part of a modern Orthodox Jewish community. And so that's the boat from which I'm reporting. I think that each of us is triggered in our own ways. And so, yes, gender definitely plays a role in that. In my family, I'm doing all the cooking, right? But also my husband is running a school and I'm not. And so there's tension that we sometimes have around that and we're trying to navigate that. I think that each family is navigating the challenge of whatever the nature of their boat is, however their boat was set up. Now suddenly there's tremendous more pressure on that system. That's really challenging for each family. This is therefore an adaptive process for parents. There's a loss for parents in terms of that maybe ability to say, we're not responsible for this part. I got to figure out how to toilet train my kid and, you know, turn them into a mensch and teach them how to eat and cook and whatever it is we're teaching our kids at home. But actually now I'm responsible for their education. That's an adaptive process that I think the parents need leadership around that. Right? There has to be leadership around helping the parents navigate the loss. My husband and I look at each other at 11 p.m. and we're like, can we please stop parenting right now? We have been parenting since 6 a.m. I'm done. When do I get to stop? And right now, that's just the situation we're in. So I do think that training and resources for parents is especially critical right now, because definitely young kids, but even older kids left alone on their devices to interact with whatever educators put online is not education. There has to be some transmission, some engagement. So I think that thinking about what's the parent training that needs to be happening should be a pivotal question facing all of us as educators, our schools and our camps. I think I've found that the rhythm of Jewish life, the calendar of Jewish life, has been especially soothing during this time when so much of what our normal patterns of living, all of that upheaval of, you know, basic waking up in the morning and getting in the car and going somewhere and then coming home, because of that disruption, somehow the rhythm of Shabbat and holidays and the new moon, right, Rosh Chodesh, I think that has been particularly meaningful. So I wonder if that's maybe something to play on in the summer when the days drag on endlessly, right, to think about how we can tap into the rhythm of the cycle of time and have that be a frame, a way of entering for kids. Also figuring out how to connect kids with each other in meaningful ways. I think that's one of the pluses, that's one of the bright spots of this. We can connect kids to each other anywhere in the world, right? My children have cousins in Israel. They're spending a lot more time with those cousins now that we're not spending time in person. And think about expanding, you know, blowing the walls off of our institutions and expanding. I think that also can be exciting.
But Maya, you did write an article in E-Jewish Philanthropy recently. And of course, all of these articles and the people that we referenced during this broadcast will be listed on our website for people to access. But the first thing you said to Jewish educators out there was to acknowledge the loss. Why start with loss? And what were some of the other things you pointed towards?
I think the last point about loss is to remind us that, again, I think of about three circles that we're in. There's the circle of the past, or what was the present 5 minutes ago, right? Somebody wrote about the end of the handshake, right? Kaddish for a handshake. That's how we used to greet each other. And who knows, that might be in the past circle, right? Then there's this present circle of what currently is. And then there's this future circle. And adaptive work and leadership means helping us move through the present, right, into what's going to be. By definition, we're going to have to let go of certain things from the past, right? So some things we're happy to let go of. And I think that that's also something we can celebrate, right? My eighth grader, school starts right now for her at 9 or 9:30 in the morning. She is so happy to let go of that 6:30 a.m. wake up to get out of the house by 7:15, right? So are there things that we can let go of with joy? Are there things from the past that are losses for right now but are not losses forever? I pray for the day when we're all back in buildings and interacting as human beings with each other. Right now, that's on hold, right? So there's a sort of a loss we're sustaining, but that's hopefully not a loss forever. But then there are certain things that maybe even things that have had more of a hold on us than we've realized that we're going to have to let go of completely. And so how do we let go of that with grace so that those ghosts don't haunt us? So that's part of acknowledging loss. And I think that's part of our work as leaders is to be able to sift through what are we letting go of completely with pain? What are we letting go of with joy? And what are we putting on hold? And then these questions of what's critical to continue in the present, right? All of us have said we have to keep educating our kids, right? So we've scrambled and adapted to figure out how to do that. But then the exciting part of adaptation, and I think the joyous part of leadership is, well, what do we get to do in the future, right? And what does this mean for the future? And I heard Ron Heifetz talk recently on a webinar about there are so many amazing stories of adaptations happening left and right, right? If we think about how adaptive we are as human beings and as a human species, if we had said 2 months ago, do you know that you're going to be able to run your entire school over Zoom or figure out how to interact with kindergartners and inspire them, you know, without having them in person, I think we would have said that's impossible. We would have, I know that I have argued against using too much technology. And yet, it's incredible to see what's happening. And so, you know, we talk about silver linings, and I don't want to minimize the loss, but I think we also have to shine a light on and celebrate the positive adaptations. And I think that goes back to the dance floor balcony, that it's important maybe to dedicate time to get on the balcony, given how difficult the current dance floor is. And then you get to open that journal of positive adaptive stories and say, wow, look what we were able to do so quickly. What does that mean for how we can make change going forward?
I think it's interesting. I think that's a topic I might want to explore in a later episode in more detail, acknowledging part of what you said as well is that the current situation might be serving to exacerbate problems which already existed and putting a magnifying glass and just like the cracks might have been there, but we were able to conceal them for however long. But right now we're all being exposed and more
That's
vulnerable.
Right. So that's right. And I would also say on that point that the best advice I've been given and want to share is we should be very gentle with ourselves. Yeah. Very gentle with ourselves and very gentle with each other. This is an unprecedented, stressful, global situation. We're in a global pandemic that nobody knows exactly how it began and nobody knows exactly how it's going to end and nobody knows if it's going to be solved. Can we be kind to ourselves?
So we're coming towards the end of the hour. One thing I'd love to be able to do is ask you something which we don't often get a chance to ask people in the field. Who's an educator that has had an incredible influence on your life and who you are? And I'd love to give you the dance floor now, or the floor now, to acknowledge and pay tribute to that educator in your life.
Well, thank you. I guess I want to start by thanking all the educators again who are listening and who are on the call, to thank them. I'm inspired every day. And I will answer that question by sharing that my father is somebody who has been an inspiration to me as an educator and as a person. He started working for Sesame Street back in 1970 when he was doing a PhD on the intersection of education and entertainment. And I think that was a radical, back to radical, right? Wild concept back then. Can television be a source of education for kids? Most people thought no. Most people thought that it was at best mind-numbing and at worst would incite violence. But the Sesame Street folks argued that we've got kids watching TV. Actually, there's a great article recently in the New Yorker by Jill Lepore about the history of Sesame Street. And it's astounding. I can't remember exactly how many hours a week she said back in 1970 kids were sitting and watching TV, but it was a lot of hours and they weren't quarantined. There was no global pandemic. So this forward-thinking, joyous celebration of the combination of technology and education that my father has embodied and dedicated his career to, I think is all the more relevant and inspiring right now. I used to argue with him that good education needed to happen in person, face-to-face, with deep relationships. And he said, yes, and. You can also fall in love with Grover, and he can help break down racial tension and inequality and teach kids who otherwise wouldn't learn their ABCs and 1-2-3s, give them the basics of preschool. And it turned out to be true. So yeah. I think we can all take inspiration from that story.
Now, it's funny that you mentioned Grover, because if you do a Google search of Maya Bernstein, there is a YouTube clip of Maya interacting with Grover as a young girl, and I think it brings to life what she's talking about now. Maya, I'm going to ask you, can you give us one message to take forward from this conversation? What's one thing you'd like to leave our viewers, our listeners with as we reach the end of the hour?
There's a piece from the Talmud from Masechet Horayot that I've been thinking about, that I'd love to leave that image with everybody. It's an argument about what's better, Oker Harim, uprooting the mountain, or Har Sinai, sort of being present at the mountain. And of course, in Talmudic fashion, there's debate and they end up arguing on the one side and arguing on the other side, and there's no real conclusion. But I think that this metaphor of Har Sinai, of this is the source of everything, is a metaphor for how things have been. We could think about being in school together as being at Har Sinai, or being at camp together as being at Har Sinai. And right now we've been forced to uproot. We've been uprooted from the mountain. But I think that maybe we don't have to imagine it as an either or situation. It's not an all or nothing, right? Can we imagine putting Har Sinai in our backpacks, taking some of the stones of Har Sinai and walking around with Har Sinai on our backpack? And I think that's the challenge and the joyous imperative of this time. Yes, there's a loss of not all being at Har Sinai right now. And at the same time, we are all learning how to carry those mountains on our backs. And so I want to encourage us and challenge us and bless us with the ability to have that fortitude, the courage, the forward thinkingness, the ability to let go, but not turn into Lot's wife and turn into a pillar of salt, and instead look forward and take this mountain on our back and not let it go. And who knows what beauty we will be blessed to encounter going forward.
So I introduced Maya as friend and colleague. I forgot maybe the important thing was also teacher. Find for yourself a friend and acquire for yourself a teacher. In Maya, I have found that always. And I hope all of you out there have found that as well. In this hour on Together On, in this new realm of digital media, that we are able to listen together, come together in such a way. And a few thanks I'd like to say moving forward. Number one, thank you really profusely to Maya for kicking us off here. Secondly, to my whole team of the Jewish Education Project, who I don't get to thank enough. They helped me solve some of these adaptive problems behind the scene before I even know that they're problems, especially to Nessa, Greg, Karen, and Gabe, who helped bring this together.
Today's episode was produced by Dina Nussenbaum and Miranda Lapidus. Show's executive producers are myself, Karen Cummins, and Nessa Lieben. Our show is engineered and edited by Nathan J. Vaughan of NJV Media. As always, if you enjoyed adapting this season, please leave us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Even better, share this episode or any others with a friend or a colleague. To learn more about the Jewish Education Project, please visit us at jewishedproject.org, where you can learn about our mission, our history, our staff, and other episodes and features that we do have, including our educator resource portal. As always, we are proud to be a partner of UJF Federation of New York. Thanks, everybody, for listening today.